Welcome to Indie Week. John Federson here for the North Carolina Reading Service with our weekly podcast called The Independent Indie Week. The broadcast date and the publication date of the Indie Week today, July the 30th of 2026. Mentioning that after the first broadcast, which you'll hear on Friday, this will become a podcast added to our huge list of podcasts at NC Reading Service. And it's intended for listeners who are blind or print impaired. And I'm now going to head into our issue now. And our issue this week is surprisingly clear of many faceted governmental problems, issues, and as I have time for some lighter weight articles, I see, of political import anyway, except for the first article, which is about Zebulon's municipal government meltdown. And I read part of this a week or two ago, and this is an updated timeline. Zebulon Vance, the North Carolina legislator, governor, and Confederate officer for whom Wake County's easternmost town is named, is was not, according to U.S. Civil War historian John Barrett, a detail guy. Though Vance practiced law for a few years in antebellum North Carolina, his success in the courtroom was usually the result of wit, humor, boisterous eloquence, and clever retorts, not knowledge of the law. Writes Barrett. Something of that style over substance characterization feels applicable to modern elected leaders in Vance's namesake town, but unlike Vance, who was reportedly beloved by his constituents, the Zebulon Board of Commissioners has faced accusations of incompetence and untrustworthiness for the last 2 years. Since 2024, board members have been dogged by sudden resignations among their top staff. Questionable hires, a lawsuit, calls for their resignation en masse, and now an unflattering report from the state auditor's office pointing to inadequate financial controls. Part one of this timeline covered June 24 through July of 25, including dramatic resignations and a petition calling for the board's complete overhaul. Part two picks up where we left off last summer. The board had just appointed Taiwo Jayoba as interim town manager for the second time after losing two town managers in 1 year. And the five-way mayoral race and six-way board of commissioners race were picking up steam. Read about the election, the settlement in the lawsuit over Zebulon South, and the findings in a new report from the state auditor's office below. So the timeline continues now, and we are in July the 22nd last year. A resident challenges Zebulon Commissioner Quentin Miles' eligibility to run for re-election. Scott Carpenter is a longtime resident and the creator of Move Zebulon Forward and Zebulon Citizens Advisory Partnership, two groups that support a complete overhaul of the Board of Commissioners. He submitted a 67-page complaint to the Wake County Board of Elections, alleging that Miles, a sitting commissioner, did not have a, quote, permanent residence in Zebulon, and therefore was not eligible to run for re-election. The complaint, which Indy obtained, cited a slew of public records listing a few different addresses for Miles, including one outside of town limits. Among the records was a trespass warning issued to Miles by the Zebulon Police Department, instructing him to stay away from the local Sheets gas station for 3 years because he had, quote, made employees feel uneasy, asking lots of personal questions there in 2024. And next, Zebulon agrees to settle with the Deacon Development Group, which sued the town over its rejection of a rezoning proposal back in 2024. The settlement allows Deacon Development's Zebulon South project to move forward following a year of legal ping-pong. According to the August 4th board meeting minutes, stored on the town's website as part of the October 6th agenda packet, naturally, Deakin made some tweaks to its development plan as part of the settlement, adding a 15% cap on rentals and 8 more affordable units. The town attorney said the North Carolina League of Municipalities covered Zebulon's legal fees. Next entry, August 19th, last year. The Wake County Board of Election unanimously rejects Carpenter's challenge. At a hearing, Miles testified he lived at a Zebulon address, providing as evidence copies of his lease agreement, driver's license, vehicle registration, renter's insurance, and utility bills, all listing that address. The board unanimously sided with him, dismissing the complaint by Carpenter. In his closing statement, Miles called Carpenter's use of his platforms to speculate about the residency and destabilize his candidacy, cyberbullying. He said he believes Carpenter didn't care about the outcome of the hearing and had only lodged his complaint as an excuse to share the trespass warning. Later that day, Carpenter posted on Facebook that his, quote, concerns had been appeased by the hearing and he had, quote, no ill will toward Miles. Now we're on October the 6th. Zebulon Board appoints Trenton Schmidt to serve out the rest of Beverly Clark's term. Clark had resigned in June. According to meeting minutes, Miles nominated Schmidt, a local realtor, and the board approved his appointment unanimously. He would serve only until a full-time replacement could be elected and sworn in. November 5th. Jessica Harrison wins the mayoral election. Harrison received 34% of the vote, or 639 votes, enough to win under Zebulon's plurality system. Former town manager Gilbert Todd placed second with 601 votes. Former Commissioner Larry Lukes came in third with 520. Incumbent Mayor Glenn York and Commissioner Shannon Baxter received a mere 57 and 46 votes, respectively. In total, 1,800 people voted in 2025, compared to 540 in the previous mayoral election, a 240% turnout increase. Harrison's campaign probably got a boost from the Wake County Democratic Party, which endorsed her over the other Democrats in that race last summer, conferring visibility and a powerful get-out-the-vote apparatus. Also on November 5th, Miles and George Roa are elected to the town Board of Commissioners from a field of six candidates. Miles received 968 votes, retaining his seat for a second term. Roa, a first-time candidate, received 733 and replaced Schmidt. Roa was the only Republican to win a municipal election in all of Wake County in November of 25. He is a realtor, an alum of the Town Planning Board, and the creator of Zebulon en Español, a service that translates important town documents and announcements into Spanish. December 5th, Zebulon names a new town manager, Katie Crosby. Crosby came to Zebulon from the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, an advocacy organization that works on racial and wealth inequality. Before that, she served as town manager in nearby Apex for 2 years. She resigned that post in 2023. Neither she nor the town of Apex offered an explanation for her departure at the time. Crosby had previously worked as the chief of staff for the city of Toledo, Ohio, and as a municipal department director in Dayton. December 8th, the board appoints Kyle Adams to fill Harrison's vacant commissioner seat. 2 days after the new board was sworn in, they met to fill Mayor Harrison's vacant commissioner seat. The board did not solicit applications for the role or even discuss their nominees before voting. The entire process took about 5 minutes. Baxter nominated Schmidt. Commissioner Amber Davis nominated Adams, a member of the planning board. Roa nominated Jesse Brown, a former police officer who had placed third in the commissioner's race. Harrison then asked the town clerk to distribute paper ballots to the commissioners so they could vote. Harrison joked to the clerk, You have to give us very clear directions. We chop this up every time. Adams received two votes to Schmidt and Brown's one apiece. By plurality, that made him the winner. As mayor, Harrison is not allowed to vote except to break ties. After the vote, Harrison asked her colleagues, quote, is there any discussion regarding board vacancy? Rohr replied that having a discussion after the vote doesn't make any sense because it's for nothing. State law entitled the board to fill a vacancy however they saw fit. Their approach wasn't wrong, but it was quicker and less rigorous than what other municipalities opted to do. That winter, neighboring Fuquay, Verina, and Wake Forest also found themselves in the position of having elected sitting commissioners to be their mayor. Those towns solicited applications to fill their vacancies and interviewed the finalists before making their appointments. It took them weeks, not minutes, and they justified their processes to the public. All right, now we've moved up to 2026, June the 22nd. The board adopts a $30.5 million budget over resident opposition. The budget for the 26-7 fiscal year passed 4-1, with Roa voting against. It keeps the tax rate unchanged and defers about $2.2 million worth of capital projects in order to shore up the town's diminished fund balance, or savings account. In her budget message to the board, Crosby wrote that the document prioritizes financial stability after, quote, staff identified a structural imbalance between recurring operating revenues and recurring operating expenditures driven by rising personnel costs, health care expenses, operational demands, infrastructure obligations, and growth-related service demands. Residents who packed into the boardroom for a public hearing ahead of the vote were almost universally opposed. They took issue with the commissioners giving themselves a raise, even as the town cut back in other areas. WRAL reported that the mayor's salary increased from $15,000 to $20,000, and the commissioner's salaries rose from $8,000 to $16,000. Some residents seemed to believe the budget contained a deficit, which it does not. North Carolina municipalities are obligated to pass balanced budgets. Many residents publicly questioned Crosby's and the board's competence. Some wondered aloud how Zebulon, one of the fastest-growing towns in the state, will be able to accommodate growth if it's deferring capital expenditures. For nearly 2 hours, residents and board members talked past each other, with the board mostly ignoring residents' complaints. Then on July 20th, the state auditor Dave Boliak's office published a, quote, rapid response special report analyzing Zebulon's financial management between 2022 and 25. It noted the recent leadership turnover and found multiple examples of, quote, significant weaknesses in internal controls related to contracts, budget development and tracking, and the fund balance. Among the findings, the town collected millions more in revenue and spent millions less than it budgeted for all 3 years. The report notes, quote, while spending below budget is preferable to overspending, a materially overstated budget could point to poor financial forecasting or non-completion of big projects. Also, Zebulon's fund balance dropped below the minimum threshold in fiscal 25. Boliak's office found payments and reimbursements to staff and contractors that were not properly documented. And in 2024, the town reimbursed Jayoba almost $7,000 for a month-long stay in a four-bedroom Airbnb while he was serving as interim town manager. The board knew about that reimbursement and approved it. All right, we're up to July this month, July the 21st. Zebulon launches a progress dashboard in response to the auditor's report. And this is a link, and it appears as a visual in the Indie Week article, which you can find yourselves on indieweek.com. The dashboard tracks the town's work on the auditor's 10 recommendation. According to the dashboard, the town has already standardized its contract approval process and implemented another layer of oversight for outgoing payments. Our longest article in the Indie Week this week, titled Dukes in Trump's Court. Here's a list of six people who attended Duke University between 1997 and 2007. A judge who dismissed criminal charges against Donald Trump. The lawyer who defended the deportation of Venezuelan migrants to an El Salvador prison, and another who tried to convince the Supreme Court to end birthright citizenship. The white supremacist who led a notorious march in Charlottesville, Virginia, and a speechwriter fired for attending a different white supremacist event, Stephen Miller. If personnel is policy, as the political canard goes, Duke has become an important institution shaping Donald Trump's presidency, the broader MAGA movement, and the populist, conservative fringes. The reputation for ruthlessness the university earned over 30 years on the basketball court has been transported into politics, and Trump's critics have found as much to dislike about certain Blue Devils as opposing sports fans. Miller has become the face of many of Trump's policies, most notably his administration's mass roundups of immigrants, but more than a dozen other Duke graduates have joined him in working for Trump or filling out the MAGA ranks elsewhere. They have shaped some of the defining elements of the Trump era, including revitalized white nationalism, aggressive and sweeping immigration dragnets, and efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Paul Teller, a political consultant who worked in the White House in Trump's first term, said, "It feels like there are a lot of Duke alums. We even get poked at and made fun of. Oh, another Duke alum, that kind of thing. That wouldn't be said, like, if there were two of us, right? People say that because we're kind of everywhere." Trump World is a surprising place for Duke grads to gather. The school is by and large known as an apolitical place. It lacked major upheaval, even as Gaza encampments sprouted up at universities across the country. Graduates tend toward consulting firms, law schools, and medical programs, not the Hill. And the political leanings that do exist clearly tilt left. Indeed, in terms of sheer numbers, other schools are better represented in Trump's White House, but Duke alumni have consistently made headlines throughout Trump's second term. Interviews with Duke alumni and professors revealed that some prominent MAGA figures, most of whom did not respond to requests for comments, were in many ways a product of the university's history at the turn of the millennium. In the early 2000s, Duke was a hotbed for emerging academic trends and recruited an increasingly elite student body. The ensuing culture wars proved to be a crucible for young conservatives on campus. Baron Soka, a conservative student leader at the time and now a Trump critic, says if the Duke of the 1990s had been a more open, intellectually honest culture, you would not have seen all these people come out of Duke. Duke officials declined to comment or did not respond to questions about this story, and its alumni engagement and Duke and D.C. teams did not respond to requests for info about their programs or alumni employment data. Who's who? In April, 3 days after Duke men's basketball team lost in the NCAA tournament, Duke alumnus D. John Sauer took the spotlight in a different court, as Trump became the first sitting president in history to attend oral arguments at the Supreme Court. Sauer, the U.S. Solicitor General and a graduate of 1997, sought to convince the justices that the 14th Amendment does not guarantee citizenship to everyone born in the United States. It would have been a radical revision of accepted immigration law, largely because the first sentence of the amendment seems to say plainly otherwise. The day did not go well. Sauer earned widespread derision for stumbling over a question about how the administration's interpretation would impact Native Americans, and the court ruled against him in July, though Trump is seeking a rare second hearing on the issue. The Assembly, and that is a news journal which the IndyWeek partners with now, identified over a dozen more Duke alumni playing memorable roles around Trump. They include Ken Starr, a 1973 Duke law graduate most famous for running the investigation that led to Bill Clinton's impeachment, who was on Trump's defense team during his first impeachment trial. Eileen Cannon, a 2003 grad and Trump-appointed district court judge for Southern Florida, was randomly selected to oversee the trial over his handling of classified documents. She controversially dismissed the charges and will now oversee legal proceedings against those who led the prosecution. Drew Enzen, a 2002 grad now leading immigration litigation for the Department of Justice, represented the White House in court during its attempts to deport a group of Venezuelan migrants to a notorious El Salvador prison. A whistleblower accused him of conspiring to allow deportation flights to continue despite court orders. The judge began contempt proceedings as a result, though an appeals court panel halted them in April. The case is still proceeding through courts. Two other Duke alumni have been so extreme in their immigration stances that Trump has occasionally distanced himself from them. The most famous is Richard Spencer, perhaps known for getting punched on camera at Trump's 2017 inauguration. Spencer was a leader of the alt-right. He even coined the term. The movement helped mainstream the fervent anti-immigrant arguments coming to fruition today. He spent 2 years as a doctoral student in history at Duke before leaving in 2007, the same year that Darren Beatty enrolled in the political science PhD program. After completing his degree in 2016, teaching at Duke for a year, Beatty joined the White House as a speechwriter. He was fired in 2018 after CNN reported he had spoken at a white nationalist conference. Beatty launched Revolver News, a conservative outlet. They claimed the FBI was behind violence at the January 6th riot. Trump brought Beatty back for his second term to serve as acting president of the U.S. Institute of Peace and a senior State Department official. He has since left both roles. A key event launched Spencer and Miller on their trajectory to prominence. That was the 2006 Duke lacrosse case, in which three white students were falsely accused of rape by a black woman hired by the lacrosse team to dance at an off-campus party. But the roots of that campus culture clash date further back. Duke's most famous alumnus is also its most infamous, former U.S. President Richard Nixon, a Republican who graduated from the law school in 1937. He said in a 1960 speech in Greensboro, "I always remember that whatever I have done, past or may do in the future, Duke University is responsible one way or the other." Through the 1970s, Duke was still a regional college, if an impressive one. But as the Reagan Revolution swept the country, Duke embarked on a program of outrageous ambitions. That's a phrase that has become a core part of the university's mythos since their school's former president, Terry Sanford, uttered it in 1984. The goal was to become an elite global research university. It worked. The same year as Stanford's speech, the New York Times labeled Duke as a hot college, especially for wealthy New Englanders. Add in basketball success, and the university was suddenly a national power flooded with elite applicants. One of them was Shulka, who said he turned down scholarships elsewhere because his parents wanted him to go to the best-ranked school that admitted him. In 1998, that was Duke, then number 3 in that still-novel U.S. News and World Report rankings. Shulka was disappointed by the culture he found on campus, which lacked debate organizations with the history of UNC Chapel Hill's dialectic and philanthropic societies, or elite gatherings like Harvard's Porcellian Club. He said, "All of a sudden you had this small, sleepy school that was now a big deal, that didn't have the institutions like a debate society. That's what I really wanted in retrospect." Shulka identified as a libertarian, so he and his conservative friends looked to political groups instead. The conservative publication on campus, the Duke Review, was a soon-to-fold project dominated by a student committed to capitalist iconoclast Ayn Rand. So they ruled that out. They felt the Republican Club was ineffectual. Quote, they were not interested in ideas, let's just put it that way. Shulka. So he and his friends tried to take it over, but were rebuffed. Lacking other options, the friends founded the Duke Conservative Union. When the organization launched a magazine in 2001, they called it New Sense, and the homonym was intentional, serving as a campus nuisance. New Sense was a point of pride. The group was a pre-internet version of the young right-wing trolls who have powered MAGA for the past decade. One New Sense headline, yes, we are hateful people. After their staff found an issue in a campus bathroom stall, they placed a target in the next issue and labeled it, piss here. Enemy number one for the Duke Conservative Union were the faculty, who were increasingly adopting the postmodern social and political theories the Trump administration is currently trying to stamp out. During the era, Duke brought in unabashed academic radicals across its humanities departments, including Frederick Johnson, a towering figure in Marxist scholarship, Walter Mignolo, a semiotician and progenitor of decolonial theory, and Ariel Dorfman, a novelist and former advisor to the socialist Chilean president Salvador Allende. But the university's crown jewel was the English department, which was fashionable enough to merit New York Times profiles. Under the leadership of renowned scholar Stanley Fish, it hired Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick, one of the founders of Queer Studies, feminist scholar, and Fish's wife, Jane Tompkins, critical theorist Barbara Herrnstein Smith, and a prominent African-American studies scholar, Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Shulka and his friends revolted against this academic boundary pushing. The first issue of New Sense called for the abolition of the pseudo-discipline known as women's study. Nearly every issue of the magazine's four-year run echoed that call or expanded it to other departments, and Shulka described the Fish era in one article as a time when the serious gave way to the silly, so long as it was trendy. The union's guiding principles backed the free market, individual rights, and the, quote, value of the Western tradition. They also rejected egalitarianism on the grounds, quote, civilized society requires order and classes. Beyond sweeping political objections, conservatives thought Duke's intellectual trend-chasing undermined their education. As a senior, William English, then president of the Conservative Union, blamed, quote, the fractured incoherence of most programs of study for his dissatisfaction with Duke, along with, quote, the shallowness of student life, the mediocrity of student interests. Shulka says he looked for a class on British history one semester and only found gender and power in Britain. He said, it's a fine topic for people who have already had the 101 course on modern British history, but with a room full of students lacking a grounding in the basics, it didn't work. It was a terrible class, he said. It can sound like standard conservative grumbling, especially since English would return for his PhD, and course catalogs from the era show many British history survey courses. But the faculty had similar complaints. Just before Shulka arrived on campus, an external review committee performing a regular audit of the English department was, quote, shocked by what they found. Journalist David Yaffe wrote in a 1999 article, quote, the department still finds itself without anything we would be disposed to describe as an undergraduate or a graduate curriculum. It concluded, the English faculty also turned on each other, accusing their colleagues of homophobia and anti-intellectualism. Sedgwick told the New York Times after she decamped for New York City, I would say two-thirds of the decision had to do with my loss of respect for the department I was in. The judgment from her young political opponents was even harsher. Michael Munger, a political science professor at Duke, said this: if you were a particular kind of student who was a militant conservative, and those are the people that are most likely to go into politics, that subgroup came to Duke and felt betrayed. The disorganization left under Duke's showy surface, thanks to a quick journey to the global academic elite, amplified the problem. For the young conservative, there was a void of culture and curriculum. Shulka said what filled that gap was, on the left, a sort of theatrical progressivism of people who were really smug and self-righteous about fairly picayune things, and then people who reacted against it, like me. And it kind of pushed us all together. The next segment of this article is called Eating Your Liver. By the time Miller enrolled at Duke in 2003, the battle lines were clear. Miller was well prepared to enter the fray, having been mentored in high school by right-wing writer and provocateur David Horowitz, according to a 2020 biography. Miller and his like-minded peers adopted a laser focus on a perceived lack of conservatives on campus. Miller wrote in a 2003 New Sense article, "Left-wing slant in college is normal. Perhaps this explains why its presence at Duke does not seem to be an issue of great concern to many students and faculty members." But Munger, who was the Duke Conservative Union's faculty advisor in 2005, thinks Duke's young gadflies got it wrong. When he was first named chair of his department in 2000, Munger said he looked up the party affiliations for faculty. At all the top 20 political science departments in the country, Duke had more Republicans than the other 19 combined, though there were just five of them. "Duke is disproportionately a place where conservatives feel comfortable," he said. "They are still only a tiny minority, but the number is not zero. And that's what distinguishes Duke from other places." The Republican core alone is likely not enough to attract more conservative students, but it played a role, especially combined with its location in the South. 2011, Duke graduate Josh Hammer, who is now a Trump-friendly writer and podcaster, says, "I was politically on the right as early as middle school or high school, so I was excited that it was outside of the liberal Northeast bubble. But I wouldn't say that it was close to top of mind." What Duke's Republican friendliness did, according to Munger, was attract, quote, "a disproportionate number of people who feel their conservative identity is an important part of their intellectual life." Students like Miller and Shulka, who were true believers in the cause. But what made them stand out most on campus was not their conservatism. It was that they expressed strong partisan beliefs at all. After all, several Trump administration figures besides Miller were at Duke around the same time, though the assembly did not find evidence they were involved with the conservative union. M. Shedi Malaklu, a 2007 graduate who is often thought of as Miller's left-wing analog, thanks to the sex column she wrote for the student paper, said, "We were not a political campus. You put your head down and do your work, and then you party hard." Despite the impression conservative students had about their teachers, something similar was true of the faculty, too. Administrators were not so much concerned with politics as with what furthered the university's reputation, said Michael Hart, that Marxist literature professor who was occasionally the target of New Sense barbs. Fish was a moderate Republican after all. Hart said, "Focusing on the brand is indifferent toward different political positions, and that does give a kind of freedom for professors." But the Duke lacrosse scandal upended things. For conservatives who already felt marginalized, the charges against three lacrosse players surfaced their worst fears about the persecution of white men in a pluralistic society, especially when some faculty signed a public letter decrying, quote, the anger and fear of many students who know themselves to be the object of racism and sexism. When then Attorney General Roy Cooper dropped the charges and declared the players innocent, they felt they had proof. In an article about the role of the scandal in birthing the alt-right, New York Magazine reported that Spencer dropped out of Duke because he was offered a job at the American Conservative after speaking on a panel about it. Still an undergraduate student, Miller defended the players on cable news and devoted much of his biweekly Duke Chronicle column to the issue. He later told The Atlantic it was the thing he was most proud of from his time at Duke. Miller was always incendiary, but Munger, who worked with Miller to organize a number of events over his 4 years, believes that energy was once aimed at constructive ends. One 2007 event on affirmative action, just before Cooper declared those players innocent, stands out in his memory. Miller already had the combative persona he adopts on TV now, but he used it to drill down into real issues in a way that even liberal professors told Munger they found enlightening. Miller's disgust at the lack of repentance from faculty who signed the letter and the lack of punishment from the university changed him. Munger said the two grew apart, and from afar, Munger saw a person changed. It just broke him, he said, and Miller decided to, quote, eat his own liver for the rest of his life. With 30 years of hindsight since he started the group that nurtured Miller and other future Trump world figures, Shoka sees it slightly differently. His erstwhile allies had always been ready to join a cult of victimhood, he said. Partisan divides on campus, affirmative action, immigration, the lacrosse case, all are events that presented conservatives as a beleaguered minority, and that gave Miller and the others an excuse to lash out, says Shulka. Some of the Duke alums from that era who made it to Trump's orbit knew each other on campus. Miller and Spencer met through the Conservative Union. Spencer told Mother Jones he knew Miller well, though Miller has pushed back on that claim, and disavowed Spencer's belief. English, the acting chair of the NEH, preceded Miller as the Conservative Union's president, told the Duke Chronicle in 2017 that he and Spencer both periodically advised the group while Miller ran it. But Hammer said there's not much of an alumni network shepherding students into Trumpist political circles. He said he met Beatty while living near him in Florida, Miller through non-Duke friends years after graduation. White House official Andrew Giuliani at a mutual friend's engagement party, and former Associate Attorney General Jesse Panuccio through the Federalist Society, that's a powerful national group for conservative lawyers. That informal, even haphazard network stands in contrast to what exists at other elite schools. One reason Biden's staff was stocked with Harvard graduates is that long-running social clubs provide backroom networking. Stanford, meanwhile, built connections to Silicon Valley investors who turned that university into a talent incubator by hosting events, launching fellowships, and spending their days in campus coffee shops. Young MAGA believers at Duke don't have such a pipeline to follow, especially in the Trump administration. Duke's most prominent conservative faculty, including Munger and his political science colleague Peter Feaver, a former official in the George Bush W. White House, are publicly opposed to Trump. Hammer said, if there's a formal network, if there's a WhatsApp chat or anything like that, I'm not a part of it. I'll put it to you that way. The closest Duke has may be Teller, a political consultant who worked in the White House during Trump's first term. He makes a point of returning to campus to speak to classes and meet with budding conservatives, including this last April, a week before he spoke to the assembly. He met both Hammer and Miller while speaking to political science classes, and Hammer asked Teller for advice and connections shortly after he moved to D.C. But Teller told the assembly his trips to mentor Duke students happen on an ad hoc basis, as his time and interest allowed, not through any official Duke programs. Complicating things further is the fact that Teller is a close ally of former Vice President Mike Pence, who has had an uneasy relationship with MAGA since the January 6th rioters chanted for him to be hanged. Joka, now president of the technology think tank Tech Freedom, is not part of Duke's MAGA network either. He has cut ties with his fellow conservative union alumni. He said, "It starts about some silly thing like what counts as sweatshop labor, and if they're better off, you don't buy goods from their countries." He summarized how Duke's conservative intellectual climate developed over the decade when it proved the most important future Trump officials. Then it becomes gay marriage, and then it becomes whether these white players were properly accused. Pretty soon it was the Holocaust a good idea? Well, your host, that is to say me, has misjudged the lightheartedness of this issue of Indie Week. The next article I'm prepared to read is titled, "Is North Carolina Ready for an Invasion of Bee-Killing Hornets?" On a muggy day in June, Don Hopkins was conducting a routine bee inspection when his phone rang. He's an apiarist at the NC Department of Agriculture and visiting hives around the state to check for pests and disease is part of his job. The bees need a clean bill of health before their keepers can sell or transport them out of state. Hopkins had been lifting frames, alive with furry industry, from a row of hives at an industrial-scale store in Raleigh when he got the call. "She found what?" he yelped to his colleague. The department had received a credible report from Charlotte that there had been a sighting of the Vespa velutina, known colloquially as a yellow-legged hornet. The bloodthirsty invasive species that devours honeybees with abandon had been slaughtering its way north from Georgia since 2023, but this would be the first official sighting in our state. Hopkins pulled up his email and zoomed in on the picture his colleague sent. It showed a blur of black and gold, a tangle of legs and transparent wings. And Hopkins said, "I think I'm going to be going down to Charlotte tomorrow." It turned out to be a false alarm. The yellow-legged hornet resembles other insects, and this one was probably just a paper wasp, which is harmless. Hopkins breathed a sigh of relief on behalf of everyone in North Carolina's robust beekeeping community. The real call came a month later. Last week, a Union County woman noticed a strange hornet snooping around her hummingbird feeder and called the state. Inspectors raced in and, according to a press release from the Agriculture Department, found additional hornets on the border between Union and Mecklenburg counties. After 3 years of false alarms, the yellow-legged hornet was officially here. This hornet appeared in France in 2004 and has since spread across 9 countries in Western Europe. Studies have found that the hornets have killed up to 30% of French honeybees every year since then, with an annual estimated economic loss of up to 30 million euros. Research out of the United Kingdom showed that in addition to honeybees, the hornets feed on 2 kinds of bumblebees, meaning their diet consists of Europe's top pollinators. And that in some parts of Europe, like Galicia and Portugal, the hornets will snack on sweet fruits, like grapes, with up to 83% of farmers reporting crop damage. Since the hornet was first spotted in Savannah, Georgia, 3 years ago, it has been making its way north at an estimated 50 miles per year. Greg Wickens, biological control administrator at the State Department of Agriculture, said, "Since the hornet is still a newcomer here, there's a major need for research on its biology and behavior in North America. Honeybees and other pollinators comprise more than 60% of these hornets' diets." Wiggins said, "When you're taking that much of a species out of the system in a localized area, it can have drastic impacts." Needless to say, officials are worried. So are beekeepers. The honeybee is North Carolina's state insect, and our state is home to the largest beekeeping association in the country with more than 4,000 members. These bee lovers, hobbyists, and professionals alike are preparing to defend their beloved pollinators. Whitaker Granis, president of the Cumberland County Beekeepers Association, says they went through Europe in about 20 years. I hope it doesn't come to that here, but I think it's time to start preparing for it. Here's how the hornets likely appeared in the U.S. According to Granis, around 4 years ago, a yellow-legged hornet queen buzzed into a shipping container in her native home of China. Months later, she landed at the port of Savannah. Queens mate in the fall and gestate over winter. As soon as she established a nest, she started churning out hundreds more like her. Granis said the biology of these insects is so invasive, they've evolved to evade new territory. Threats to honeybees are nothing new. These scrappy pollinators are valued both for their cuteness and for their essential contributions to agriculture, which is an $111 billion industry in North Carolina alone. But they've faced colony collapse, disorder, parasites, mites, and more over the past decades. The yellow-legged hornet is a particularly gruesome and pernicious predator. They are not the same as the giant, quote, murder hornets that captured the collective imagination when they invaded Washington State in 2019, but they're still pretty murderous. Beekeepers usually detect them because of something called hawking behavior. When hungry, the hornets scope out a beehive, then body check each other for a prime spot at the hive entrance. There they lay and wait for the worker bees to come home. Hopkins described this behavior as, quote, like a hockey goalie. But the results are more House of the Dragon than heated rivalry. When worker bees return exhausted from foraging, the hornets attack. They behead the bees, devour their protein-rich insides, and then leave their corpses in a heap. Sometimes they even cart the bodies home to their own nests to show off. Granis said there are stories about beekeepers coming back and their hive is in really bad shape with a pile of dead honeybees with their heads all ripped off. Eventually, forager bees stop leaving to look for sustenance and the hives die. The hornets are also prolific. In spring, mated queens emerge from hibernation to establish a nest and raise workers. As their population expands throughout the summer, the workers venture out in droves to prey on honeybees, and the whole cycle begins again each fall. What makes yellow-legged hornets distinct, besides their bloodthirstiness, is their ability to reproduce exponentially. Each new nest, which can grow to 4 feet tall and house up to 1,000 spawn, can produce up to 600 queens, and up to 50% of them survive. Each of those 300 queens can then spur a new nest. The Department of Agriculture has inherited several nests to use as educational materials. Hopkins keeps one, which he's nicknamed Top Gun, in his truck. It's the size of a car tire, and the color of sand, made up of papery whorls and sunken caves and studded with combs. It looks like it was designed by a demented troll. Hopkins and other bee aficionados are hopeful that Top Guns won't spread throughout our state. They're currently hunting for the nest in Union and Mecklenburg counties so they can destroy it before the hornet spreads. But some beekeepers, like Granis, say it's time to prepare for the worst. Granis started keeping bees when he moved back into his home state from Denver 14 years ago. I met him on a farm outside Hope Mills, where the Cumberland County Bee Association keeps hives for education and training for its members. The row of hives crouches at the edge of the tree line. Wearing a mesh bee hat, orange gloves, and a neck fan to stave off summer heat, Granis stuffed his smoker, that's a small handheld device used to drive bees out of their hives with smoke, with Amazon packaging and the pine needles so ubiquitous in the Sand Hill region. He lit the smoker, approached a hive from behind, and gently lifted the lid. It was stuck to the rest of the structure with a sticky, resin-like propolis, that is to say, bee glue. This hive originally established itself in the wall of a house. A beekeeper saved it by meticulously cutting it out and nursing it back to health, then donated it to the association for educational purposes. As soon as they realized their hive was open, the bees roared to life. Granis lifted up a frame, searching for the queen. Like most beekeeper, Granis adores his bees, and for the last 3 years he's feared the arrival of their worst predator is only a matter of time. Hopkins, Keller, and other experts carry pocket-sized information cards with images of native hornets to compare with the newcomers. The European hornet, which was introduced in the 1840s and does not prove a threat to honeybees, sports all yellow legs. Confusingly, the yellow-legged hornet's legs are only half yellow, like it's wearing socks. The visual similarities could explain why Hopkins received nearly 400 false alarms before the real call came this month. In some parts of Europe, scientists are using high-tech tracking methods to root out the yellow-legged hornets, including attaching tiny transmitters to track the hornets back to their nests. But here in North Carolina, the methods are simple and low-cost, a citizen science initiative rooted in passion. Hopkins and other bee inspectors are giving presentations to the 82 county associations around the state. Officials and volunteers are handing out educational material at state fairs, green industry shows, all sorts of agricultural-themed events. Wiggins said the state is planning to hire an outreach coordinator. With approximately 50,000 beekeepers in North Carolina, they have a lot to do. Jennifer Keller, a research specialist and apiary expert at NC State, beekeepers are going to be the first to spot it. They'll be out around their bees and they'll see this hawking behavior. She and her colleagues tell beekeepers if they spot a suspicious hornet, they should call their county beekeeping association and state inspectors immediately. The six inspectors covering separate geographical territories are ready to race into the field to determine if it's actually the fearsome pest, and if so, trace it back to its nest. Traps are an essential tool in hornet tracking. They aren't fancy. Just a white half-gallon jug with a square hole cut in the side. Beekeepers fill these jugs with so-called Georgia juice, a mix of brown sugar and grape juice that's available for purchase but easy to make at home. Bees don't like it, but hornets do. The hope is that thirsty hornets stop on their way to the beehive for a drink, fall in, and drown. Then officials can examine them to confirm the species. Once hornets are confirmed in an area, officials will then set out traps containing just a little bit of Georgia juice, enough to lure the hornets, but not enough to kill them. More than 200 such traps now dot the landscape around the home where the hornets made their first known incursion. Once the hornets visit the traps and fly off, bee inspectors can trail them to their nests. Hopkins has traps up at the Piedmont Triad Farmers Market in Greensboro and the State Farmers Market in Raleigh in case a yellow-legged hornet hitches a ride into the heart of the state on an agricultural truck. At the North Carolina State Beekeepers Association meeting in Winston-Salem earlier this month, state agriculture representatives handed out trap after trap. Wiggins explained to the steady stream of concerned beekeepers that the traps each have two QR codes, once to log when you set it, and once to sound the alarm if you see an insect sporting these yellow knee-highs. Anthony Badeau of Catawba Valley Beekeepers also stopped by for a trap because, quote, he has a problem with local hornets using my apiary as a pantry. In early July, he remained hopeful that our southern neighbor's efforts, spearheaded by an academic and state regulatory partnership at Clemson University, would contain the predators. What worries him most, he is a weekend beekeeper. If something showed up to menace his hives on a Tuesday, by the time he notices it might be too late. Badeau said, it's like leaving your kid behind in a grocery cart. That kind of sentiment is common among North Carolina beekeepers. In some states, beekeeping is largely a commercial enterprise. In California, for example, vast agricultural operations rely on bees to pollinate their crops. While commercial beekeepers are an essential here too, our state is also home to thousands of hobbyists. Many are retirees. Some are veterans who keep bees to work through PTSD. Beekeepers describe this as a way of life. They tell stories about starting with a casual hive or two and then getting sucked in with dozens. In short, the hornets are messing with an insect that's beloved to thousands of North Carolinians. Granis says most people who are beekeepers are very, very passionate about keeping their bees healthy, keeping them safe. At the conference, beekeepers walked away from the booth with armfuls of pamphlets, stickers, pens, and those orb-like traps, ready to return to the far-flung reaches of the state and guard their hives, ready for whatever is to come. I barely have time to get into, I'm still waiting for the lighthearted story. This isn't it. Why are Durham breweries drying up? Asks this article. I'm basically just going to have time to give you the title. It's about brewery closings around Durham and elsewhere in the state. Another article is actually 1 week old. I didn't get to it last week either. All about the Sir Walter Hotel in downtown Raleigh, which was an epicenter of North Carolina politics for over four decades. A music article titled A Night Out at Easy Street. This was Easy Street Cafe. There's a character studies series in Indie Week, short vignettes about various people around the triangle. The one I'm not able to read you today is about Cook Ariel, urban boat captain, who keeps three boats under tarps and docked next to a two-story brick apartment. Well, and I must stop now. This broadcast, which we will first hear on Friday, will now then be relegated to the podcast section of NCReadingService.org. You can find this and other issues, thousands of them, in that space. But you could also visit online to IndieWeek.com, which is a free publication online where you can read all the articles I was unable to get to and others as well, photographs included, web links included. Hope you'll give it a chance. So John Fetterson will be with you again next week for the North Carolina Reading Service. Thanks for listening to the Indie Week.